Accession number 20370, Ron Forbes, Reel 10.
Mr. Forbes, Reel 10. We're talking about the fighting in Holland, and the next thing really is Veulen, where I believe you had a bit of a close escape. If you could tell us what happened, what the background was to that.
From my memory, the scene was there was a canal, and the enemy, or there was a self-propelled gun firing across the canal, and we had to run a sort of, well, in my case it was a running a gauntlet between two wooded areas, and in doing that I was fired on, and I had to turn a bit, and in doing so I slowed down enough for these four or five hits with itchy, and I was extremely lucky there, because if the SP had armour piercing shells, it would have been a different story, because where the first one hit the side of the tank was just practically where my head was, you know, being down, closed up.
The hatch was closed.
Yeah, so I was, I think I had nine lives, like a cat or something, I don't know. But
what was it like in the tank when you got an HE hit like that?
Well, having a fairly good close set of earphones, you got a sort of shock, you know, but you couldn't say that you got a lot of noise. I suppose if your ears were exposed, it would be quite a bang, you know, but it didn't get a lot of effect. Not from itchy, but I suppose it would be different. I was lucky enough never to be experiencing an armoured piercing encounter.
You were hit by more than one shell, were you?
I think it was about five. There was one on the turret ring which made a dent in it, but didn't penetrate. One on the periscope, and two on the side. Where the fifth one went, I think it had just hit the gun muzzle and glanced off, because it's hard steel. It wouldn't penetrate that. I think the fifth one glanced off, because there was a slight mark on the barrel of the gun, but not much.
Anything else about what happened at Veulen?
No, from then on there was quite a few bursts of itchy and quite a lot of Spandau. I can remember hearing a lot of that after that, and we just went on, and we did quite a lot of hanging about, shall we say, until we got called into the thing that was always lovely to hear, and when you reached the end of the day, was the QM calling up for requirements, you know, if anybody had any special requirements that they wanted. And you find that was the signal for the recall into harbour. So the day ended with that, usually. So you were prepared to move back or into wherever the lager was, you know, after that.
Was there a lot of hanging about? You've got a cartoon of
there was quite a lot. Especially, you would do quite a bit of motoring and quite a bit of movement, and then you would reach a point where obviously there was an obstacle in the way, some kind of action going on. And if you were behind that, you got little items across the wireless, you know, that something was going on, but whenever you stopped, your main objective was to find a position to observe, really. So usually you got stuck in a hedge or someplace, and you might be hours there.
What would we do?
We brewed up, had a cup of tea, something to eat maybe, and if it was safe to go out, you went out and did what you needed to do out and got back in again quickly. But most of the time you just argued, discussed. If somebody supported Sheffield United and somebody supported Sheffield Wednesday, an argument was bound to develop there. But that sort of thing went on between the crew members, you know. Discussed things. Discussed politics as well sometimes. I was never well up on politics, so I used to just sit and listen and add a few remarks now and again. But that was mainly how you occupied the time. By
did they discuss the war much, or what they were doing there, or that sort of thing?
Quite a lot, yes. Especially if we'd heard last night's broadcast from the BBC on the radio, because that's how most of the time we found out how we got on. We didn't sometimes know how we did that day. When we got to the end of the day, so when we got a minute to spare, it was the BBC that told us how far we'd advanced.
What did you think of their broadcasts?
Very good. There were. There must have been a good link between the frontline rep and in London, because you got really information not long after the action had stopped.
Was it accurate, or was it propaganda, or was it a mixture of...
I couldn't argue about that, because you didn't really know. You just took everything for granted that was said on the radio.
Did you listen to other broadcasts? I mean, could you get Lord Haw-Haw or anything?
No. You see, they only had odd minutes when you got back to harbour. You were filling up and replenishing things, and you didn't get time to sit and listen to the radio. You just tuned in at maybe 8 o'clock or something to get, if you were lucky enough to be finished by then. But then by after midnight, if you were late getting finished, there was nothing you could do. Just try and get some sleep.
Anything else about your time in Holland? There was a period, you seem to have been in billets and dugouts for a while.
There was one
before they went back to Ypres.
There was one point I think we were told we might be left out of action for a fortnight or something, and we went into this little wood, and everybody got the idea that we were going to make ourselves comfortable if we were going to be there a fortnight, and we actually chopped down trees and built log cabins. And even some fellas had a little fireplaces and things built in them. And they were quite comfortable. And there was some of the tanks were replaced, and there was one or two came with radial engines in them, Pratt and Whitney radial engines in them. And we didn't like them because you had they got what's something known as hydrostatic lock, and when they were ready to be started up in the morning, and you had to do about 20 windings with a big handle to get to turn the engine over to stop this possibility of hydrostatic lock. We didn't like them. We didn't last long. They were taken away again. There was a lot of that went on when we were in that place, shifting stuff. And
was this Helmand, or do you know where it was?
Helmand,
or was it Eiselstein?
Helmand was one of the nicest places we landed in, because we all got billeted on the civilians.
So it would perhaps be Eiselstein, would it?
There was a bit of action there, I think, at Eiselstein. The name seems to... I wasn't involved. All I can remember
you don't, is... You don't know where these log cabins were then? They were just somewhere at home?
No, I'm afraid I don't. I can remember them, the wooded area and what we did, but I can't remember.
Were you in them long?
Where? Pardon?
Were you in them long, the cabins?
About a week, I think.
And what about Helmand? You said Helmand was good.
Yeah, well, before we were in Dern for a while. A place called Dern. That was where we went to after I got hit.
Boylan.
Yeah. Where is that one?
You've got a cartoon.
That was in Dern.
Tell us about that then. It was.
Yeah. Well, we landed at this spot. And I can remember Sir John coming up and looking at the tank and telling me how lucky I was and all that sort of thing. Because and we went into the village, and of course there was nobody there. There was no civilians here. But we found this house with a nice roof on it, but the walls had been breached a bit. And it was quite handy. It was just like that, really. So Bert and I, the gunner, thought, we'll have a bit of comfort. Andy Mathers was asleep in the turret. He could sleep in any position. So anyway, we decided to have a bed down in this house with a roof over our head. And it was in some hours later when we settled down, stopped talking and settled down to sleep, that these rats appeared, climbed all over us. And it was a quick rush to get back in the tank. So instead of bailing out, we bailed in that time.
And another cartoon, that was Bert Moyer in that cartoon.
Yeah,
And another one you've got is of about Andy Mathers is sleeping. That's
That one, Wake Up the Tiger.
Tell us about that story.
That was one of the times when we were stuck against a hedge, observing, and I just can't remember who was in the turret, who was the commander then. Could have been Bert Shaw, I don't know. I'm not sure. Vague. I've got a vague memory of who's there. Anyway, it was all quiet, and in the distance this tank came into sight, and it was... we could see the very sloping front of it, and it was obviously a Tiger with a long gun, so it was... that's what he... And Andy, of course, was fast asleep, and he seemed to have a wee pad that he had made that he put on against the side of the tank, and his head was against that, and that was his pillow, and he was fast asleep. And this is what happened. The commander shouted, "Wake up, Andy, there's a tiger over there." And Andy says, "It's all right, I'll waken up when the gun goes off."
He actually said that?
He actually said that, yeah. He woke up and said that and fell asleep again.
And what happened to this tiger that time?
It never came near us.
It was in the farm.
It was going from left to right, and it was difficult. It was moving quite fast. I suppose it wasn't very fast, but I don't think we didn't fire at it anyway. Some other buddy was having a go at it anyway, so we just left it. We didn't want to attract. If we fired, it would have fired back. And at that stage, it wasn't so imperative to knock out anybody because the Germans were on the point of surrendering anyway. It was quite near. I think that self-same Tiger was captured later on.
But that was in France, that incident, if Bert Shaw was...
No, that was in... that was not long after Helmand, I think.
Right, so that's in Holland.
Yeah.
And the other cartoon you've got that is where the
that one. Oh, that's a true story too.
What happened there?
The gun was pointing at 3 o'clock. You used the clock as indicating, and the gun was at 3 o'clock. So that meant that Andy Mather's hatch, the wireless operator's hatch, was immediately above the driver's hatch. And I was having a breath of fresh air with my hatch open. And, of course, Andy needed to empty his bladder. And we used a 17-pounder shell case for a pea pot, you see, and he just asked Bert had a place where it could be safely stored without tipping over, and he just asked Bert to pass him the pea pot, and Bert said, "It's full, Andy." And so Andy said, "Oh, never mind, I'll empty it over the side." Which he did. And I was completely soaked with it. And for days, well, some days anyway, I couldn't change. I just had to let this stuff dry on me, see? So I was very unpopular, and they used to call me Stinker Forbes and that. So that was that incident, which was not very pleasant, actually.
What would people do if they wanted something a little more serious in the tank and they couldn't get out?
You just had to resist it. You couldn't do anything about it. There was all sorts of unpleasant things in that score in the tank.
In what way?
Well, smells. noises. Nothing serious. Like, most people waited till there was a possibility of no harm coming to them before they got out. A German steel helmet was an excellent thing to use for that, if you could find one.
What's the next thing then? Helmand,
Helmand, we billeted on the civilians, and we all got more or less very, very friendly. One incident happened there. There was somebody, I think the sergeant major, came to me and asked me if I would go to this place. About 3 miles down the road, there was an LAD, a recovery place, and there was a Cromwell tank there ready to be brought back, one of the HQ. They didn't have a driver available. So I got a 1,500 weight lift and a 1,500 weight down to this place to bring the tank back. And while I was there, I went into the cookhouse.
Now, why were you picking up a Cromwell, kid?
We had Cromwells. We had a Cromwells in HQ. We had two Cromwells, a sort of recce tanks in HQ. And this was one of them. It had been in for a repair of some kind. And it was down a long avenue of Dutch polar trees, you know, the poplar trees that the Dutch grew a lot of over there. And this down straight road down there, and when I got there, I had to go to the cookhouse for some food, you see. And I was in there, and I spoke to the cook, and there was a corporal cook came out, and he said, "What about in Dundee do you bide?" And he was a Dundonian, you see. So we got talking, and about Dundee especially, and he says, "Anything you want when you're here?" I said, "No, I've a couple of white loaves of white bread, with the idea of taking it back to the family that I was billeted on." And he gave me 6 white loaves out of the RASC delivery. They had plenty, you see. Put them in a sack and handed it over to me, and I went back. And going down this straight road, I thought to myself, "Well, see how fast this thing goes, you know, a bit of devilment." I was on my own, nobody in the turret, and that's not supposed to be allowed. It wouldn't be allowed in England, but this was war, you see. Anyway, there was nobody in the turret, so I thought to myself, put the foot down. So I went down this road, and there was a man came out of between some trees with a bike. They all seemed to have ramshackle bikes in Holland. He came out, and of course I was coming down this, screaming down this tank of 35 to 40 miles an hour, and his hat flew off, and he flung the bike aside and dived back amongst the trees, and I passed him, and I thought to myself, "Good goodness, just had this wee hole to see through in the Cromwell," and that it was a very nice break from sort of boredom. And I got back to the family home in Helmand, and the wee girl, Dorcia, she suffered from malnutrition, and all the family gathered round these 6 loaves on the table and sort of Nellie, her name was, said a prayer. She was a very devout Catholic. She said a prayer. And my name was mentioned a few times in the prayer. So they enjoyed, Hank, her husband, he enjoyed rationing the white bread out, because the bread they had was really awful. Stodgy black stuff. Anyway, that was just a little incident that happened in Helmand. Not much else happened. We did.
What did you think of the Cromwells? Because I mean, according to the books, you were on familiarisation training in the ready for replacement of the comet. To get you ready for the comet.
Mechanically, they were very good, but they were inadequate as regards armour and gunpowder. Most of them had, well, these ones had howitzers on them. They didn't have, the normal tank gun. I thought, well, the one I drove on that occasion, I thought was very good, fast for a tank. I mean, if a tank's doing 40 miles an hour, it's a bit hair-raising, really. Anyway, I think the Cromwell was good. It's good that they adapted the Cromwell design for the Comet, because it was nice and low and well designed, I thought.
Now, from Helmand, you went to Ypres and you handed in the Shermans at Brussels. What do you remember of that?
Yeah, that's right. Well, we were reluctant to lose. Hans Muir was the name on our tank.
That was the name of your tank? We haven't talked about that. What was the thing about tank
names?
Well,
the Shermans, we adopted five towns for the names. And Hans Muir was a place in Fife. Sir John's was St Andrews, I can remember that. He picked St Andrews for his name. And they were all places in Fife, like Achtertoul and all that, little towns in Fife.
Was this all the regiment or just B Squadron?
Just B Squadron. I don't know what the rest of them had on them. Anyway, that's what we did then.
What about handing in the Sherman? How did you feel about that?
Well, in wartime, you didn't have really much sentiment with equipment and stuff, and you just handed the thing in and hoped that you would get something better, that's all, more or less. But the Firefly, you felt a wee bit safer with a bigger gun than the 75. And that's about all. You just handed your tank in, got into trucks and went back to Ypres.
Now, what were your billets like? I know you weren't there long.
In Ypres?
Yeah, what were your billets like?
Ah, well, I was with a nice family called Decock. He was a painter and decorator, so we had something in common. We used to talk a lot about paint and colours and things. And I used to... we decorated clumpers. You know what clumpers are? Well, that's what the Dutch called the clogs that they wore. And they all wore clogs outside and never went into the house with them on. That was the sort of thing that happened there. Well, the Decocks, him and Antoinette, his wife, had a large family. I think there was about six of them. And it was exciting, really, because they were quick at picking up English, more so than their mother and father. They were rare kids, and I enjoyed living with them.
How did you get on with the Belgians generally?
The Belgians?
Well, or the Ypres Belgians, you know.
Very nice people. They seemed to be more enthusiastic about liberation than the Dutch were. You got more VIP treatment. Went into cafes and pubs and things, and you just got very well treated. I think the Belgians were very nice. They've got a good enough reputation, I don't know.
And you weren't there long before, just around Christmas, so you were mobilised, well, not mobilised, but, Ardennes offensive happened.
Well, we were then... Mm-hmm. We were then... starting training on the Comets, and when the first of them arrived, we were most impressed with them, and we started training on them. We never got really very far before Christmas, and in fact, it was very near Christmas when we were mobilised again to go and up to the Ardennes to help the Americans when the Battle of the Bulge started. And we, Bert Moyer and I, we sort of said, right, boys, we'll see if we can get Hans Muir back. You know, when we went back to Brussels to pick up the Shermans, because we had to go back and them, you see. And luckily enough, when we got into the big tank park in Brussels where all the things were, we managed to get hold of Hans Muir again, 17 pounder. So we got in there, and the journey towards up towards the Ardennes was very exciting, because it's tourist country and there was a lot of very nice scenery and things, Dinan and Namur and up that way.
And what was the weather like?
The weather was clear, not bad most of the time, and very, very cold, of course, in the middle of winter, but and it was snowing a lot, so we got white paint and painted the tanks, some of the tanks white. I didn't think they were all painted white, but ours certainly was, and we had these winter tank suits, which were very good, insulated material, you know, they were good. And a place called Wavriel, up in the, fairly high up in the mountain. We had to do a bit of climbing with the Shermans to get up to it.
What was the name of the place?
Wavriel. There was two places, and I can't remember the second name, but the Wavriel was one of them. And the 6th Airborne were our support infantry at that in the Ardennes. And they came up, and between us, we got on very well. We helped out a lot with making hot drinks and things, because they didn't have the facilities for that sort of thing. But I think the Ardennes, not a lot you could say about the Ardennes, because by the time we got up there, there wasn't much action left. But I can remember we tackled an SP, and we were up on a slope, tucked in under the eaves of a house. And when this SP came out of the woods, we fired on it, and in firing, the flash and the explosion of the gun going off, all the slates fell off the sloping roof and covered us. We were covered in slates, and we had to sort of get out gingerly and clear them off, because, I mean, we couldn't traverse the turret or anything with it. Anyway, we managed to get that off. And the only other thing...
Had you hit the self-propelled gun?
Hmm?
Had you hit your target?
I can't remember, really. I think it just... we may have missed it and it disappeared, withdrew quickly.